Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the April 2025 Walter Magazine. We begin with the cover story, Weaving Wonder. Patricia Ferreira lets curiosity lead the way, one stitch at a time, by Susanna Klingenberg. As children, we were all students of the natural world. Who among us doesn't remember being mesmerized by a line of marching ants, delighted by a perfectly smooth stone? Our younger selves were willing to get up close to creation, unrushed and easily awed. Patricia Ferreira invites us back into that state of childlike wonder. Her work, colorful, mesmeric, and endlessly detailed, offers us a gentle nudge to consider, really consider, the beauty and resilience of the outdoor world. But she doesn't do it by painting sweeping landscapes. She works in textiles, a medium often thought of as a man-made and separate from nature. We see cloth used for clothing, upholstery for furniture, or bags to carry our purchases. But Ferreira challenges that limited view. I'll take a walk in the forest and notice the way the branches tangle themselves together, and I see ropes, I see yarn. Anything can be a textile, the bark of a tree, the moss on a rock. And in Ferreira's capable hands, the things we throw away serve this purpose too. Patricia's work and process are rooted in the act of salvaging, says Art Space creative director Anna Lee, who watched Ferrer's work take off when she was part of their emerging artist residency. Though Ferreira's polished pieces belie their humble beginnings, she works entirely with discarded, donated, and found items. Her studio is a jumble of yarn and thread, piles of nets, collections of plastic bottle caps, rolls of pantyhose, and assorted other objects people have discarded. It's a far cry from Ferreira's design school days. She moved to the United States from Uruguay in her 20s to study textiles, where her focus was on creating commercial products. I was being trained to make beautiful things that seduce people to buy the new and throw away the old, she remembers. It didn't sit well with her, causing such an existential crisis that she quit school for a year. Her professors eventually convinced her to finish her degree, but she's never forgotten the feeling. I guess this work now is my redemption, she says, creating things outside the realm of consumption, things for education and collaboration. Found objects are an extension of life, she says. They're a reminder that nature is constantly working through time to wear things out. It makes you ask, who's really the artist here? Sometimes I feel like I'm stealing these objects because I'm not making them, I'm just taking. She's drawn to the creativity and surprise of working with whatever materials come her way. She likens it to her favorite literary genre, magical realism. Her current read is Haruki Murakami's IQ84, because working with found objects is both grounded in the grit of everyday life and transporting otherworldly. It takes the yes and mindset of an improv artist, or perhaps of a child, to work with found objects. She says, when you find an object, it's like, okay, this is the world we're in. Here we go. Let's do this. For Ferreira, let's do this means committing an abundance of time and energy to each piece. Every one of the stitches in her work, and there are many, is done by hand. I don't use machines because I don't want to remove the humanity from the pieces, she says. Using needle and thread is an ancestral practice. It's a process people can understand. They understand stitches. They understand yarn. So when I make something with my hands, it's a built-in connection to whoever is looking at it. That connection is palpable when you view Ferreira's work, as with her recent solo exhibition, Precarious Habitats, at Meredith College. It takes active restraint not to touch the work, as the layers of detail invite you closer and closer. You can't help but imagine the actual hands of the artist working with the material, says Sarah Rose Nordgren, co-founder of School for Living Futures, which collaborated with Ferreira on an exhibition called The Future of Water at Golden Belt Arts in Durham last May. There's care in every detail. But that slow, deliberate, process-driven approach fits Ferreira's posture toward her work, that the art leads the way. It's the way of nature itself, after all, slowly changing course over decades or millennia, responding to whatever it encounters. Ferreira's bent towards collaboration is embodied in both her artwork and her role as an educator. She's led community maker events in collaboration with the North Carolina Museum of Art and ArtSpace, where she enlists strangers to work together. She's drawn toward weaving together disparate things, whether it's found objects sharing a space or people sharing a project. In human society, borders divide us, but in nature, borders aren't rigid, and nature thrives in those liminal spaces, says Ferreira. I don't think of my projects as having borders. They only end because I have a deadline or limited space, says Ferreira. Otherwise, they would go on and on forever, one thing merging into the next, like the natural world. This article was edited for Time. Next, Another World. The Juniper Level Botanic Garden offers a plant-filled escape within city limits, by Helen Yost. A short trip down what feels like a country road, by today's standards in Raleigh anyway, leads to the Juniper Level Botanic Garden. Located in the Juniper Level community of South Raleigh, it feels like you're in another world. And indeed you are. This is one of the world's most renowned botanic gardens, featuring nearly 30 acres of plants from all over the world. The Juniper Level Botanic Garden, or JLBG, started from humble beginnings, but had big ambitions. Since I was a young teen, I longed to build a garden for visitor discovery, says Tony Avent, the gardener's co-founder. In 1986, Tony and his late wife, Michelle, moved to their first home, a two-acre plot in Juniper Level. There they started a mail-order catalog company, Plant Delights Nursery, at Juniper Level Gardens, with the plants they grew. They offered native plants, but also unique and rare specimens obtained through collecting, creating, propagating, and sharing. Over the next three decades, they were able to buy neighboring land, expanding to the current 28-acre footprint. Tony didn't have a master plan for these purchases. He says, "I let the land tell me what its use would be." Over time, that land has created plenty of space for sun and shade gardens, along with more niche plantings like its aquatic/bog garden, the basalt fountain garden, and a collection of hardy banana trees. Now the land provides a space for education, propagation, research, plant sales, and visitors, says Tony. The first 2.2 acres of land are still part of the gardens. Called the Founder's Garden, this area is heavily planted and has meandering paths that lead from one garden collection to another. Here, visitors will find the original grotto garden, a small rock garden, and a bog, with plantings tucked in all available space. When walking through the garden, you'll find you need to traverse the same path in both directions, not to miss any plant treasures, says Tony. After purchasing the Eyed Horse Farm next door and selling the horses, the Abbots were able to find a use for almost everything on the property, except the concrete. Then the idea came to create a crevice garden, says Tony. On-site landscape designer Jeremy Schmidt used broken pieces of the material to create its structure. He placed the pieces like books on a shelf, with curves and just enough space in between for planting, says Tony, who filled the crevices with agaves, baptisia, hybrids, salvias, and other dryland plants from his breeding programs. Michelle's garden, honoring Tony's late wife, features a plant collection with more than 9,000 taxa collected from all over the world. In the middle of this collection is a house for staff offices, Southwest-style plantings, and a potted collection of variegated agave from all over the world. Here, too, is the famed Mount Michelle waterfall, which is sustained by recycled water from the garden's innovative rain garden. The garden operates at a break-even point, says Tony, with nursery sales funding the JLBG. Every dime Plant Delights makes goes back into the gardens and research, he says. In June 2016, Abbott endowed the garden to North Carolina State University, his alma mater. Last year, JLBG also started a membership program with varying benefits to fund the endowment, but thus far, the endowment mainly relies on donations. Tony has received many accolades for his work, including the recent and most prestigious Royal Horticultural Society Veitch Memorial Medal, of which only 27 have been awarded in the Society's 150-year history, for his outstanding contribution to the advancement of the science and practice of horticulture. JLBG hosts Open Garden Weekends 8 times per year. The next two will be the first 2 weekends in May. A walk through the grounds could convince just about any visitor that the award is well deserved. This article was edited for Time. Also from the Nature Department, Blue Beauties. It's easy to attract these cheerful native birds to your yard, by Mike Dunn. Bluebirds are creatures that everyone seems to love. They've had songs written about them, famous poems, and even sayings about them that have been in our culture for generations. My favorite quote about these beautiful birds is from Henry David Thoreau, the famous naturalist and essayist of the 1800s. "The bluebird carries the sky on its back," end quote. Indeed, the sky blue color of the male eastern bluebirds helps make this species one of our most beautiful and beloved. My real interest in bluebirds started when I began creating teacher workshops as part of a program with the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. We traveled to schools helping educators learn about their environment and feel comfortable taking their students outside on their school grounds to teach all sorts of subjects, from science to art. With grant support from the National Science Foundation, we also helped schools create mini habitats as a readily accessible learning resource. An important part of a bird habitat was providing a nest box for the bluebirds. They often nest in a hollow tree or old fence posts but have learned to seek out nest boxes. My go-to source for bluebird boxes for schools was a fascinating man named Jack Finch, who lived in Bailey, North Carolina. Mr. Jack, as he was often called, was a farmer, pragmatic naturalist, and a dedicated lover of bluebirds. Concerned about the decline of his favorite bird, Mr. Jack started the nonprofit Homes for Bluebirds in 1973, which built and sold tens of thousands of boxes stamped with the company name. His design included a 1.5-inch diameter entrance hole, small enough to keep out competitors like European starlings, a metal guard around the hole to prevent woodpeckers, squirrels, or starlings from enlarging the entrance, and a sturdy roof with an overhang and ventilation holes. Mr. Jack claimed that he didn't really design the box, the bluebirds did. He tried many different designs and settled on the one that the bluebirds preferred. If you put up a box at the right time of year, generally around February or March, bluebirds in the area will soon check it out. Mr. Jack passed away in 2006, but my durable Homes for Bluebird nest boxes still have bluebirds nesting in them every year. As I was writing this in February, the bluebirds were already visiting the box in our side yard. They typically begin nesting sometime in March or April, bringing in pine needles or dried grass as nest material. Both parents help build the nest, and once it's been constructed, the female lays one light blue or occasionally white egg each day until there are 4 to 6 eggs. After the last egg is laid, she begins to incubate them. They hatch in about 13 to 14 days, within a few hours of each other. Both parents feed the young, bringing in a variety of insects and spiders and the occasional small lizard. Waste from the baby birds is contained in a gelatinous fecal sac that's carried away by the parents and dropped far away from the nest so as to not attract predators. Young leave the nest 17 to 20 days after hatching. On the day they fledge, the parents may sit nearby with some small food item, gently calling to encourage their young to leap out into the world. The speckled young are hesitant, some taking many minutes to make that first flight. Parents continue to feed the young birds for 2 to 3 weeks after fledging. The male may take on more of this responsibility as the female starts another nest. Bluebirds often have 2 or 3 broods each nesting season. Eastern bluebirds feed on a variety of insects, spiders, and fruit. I've watched our bluebirds bring in earthworms, beetle grubs, caterpillars, and spiders to feed their ravenous young. In cold weather, they feed on berries from various native trees and shrubs. They seem especially fond of red cedar, American holly, and flowering dogwood berries. In fact, Mr. Jack sought out certain dogwood trees from yards in the region that produced abundant berries and cultivated them on his farm to sell. He's the only person I ever met that collected dogwood berries, packaged them in sawdust to prevent fungal growth, and refrigerated them to sell as bluebird food. And it worked. In winter, I would pull a few berries out of the container, place them on my deck rail, and have several bluebirds show up every morning. The most I ever saw on my deck was 14 during a January snow. Other foods you can provide for bluebirds include suet, peanut butter in winter and mixed with seed, mealworms, fresh or dried, and seed packages that contain specialty ingredients like sunflower chips, suet chips, and dried fruits such as cranberries and cherries. Of course, the easiest way to attract a diversity of birds is to provide a yard with many native plant species, a water source, and suitable sites for shelter and nesting. If you want to attract bluebirds, there are many great nest box designs on the market, or you can easily build your own. The North American Bluebird Society, nabluebirdsociety.org, has a nice fact sheet with lots of nest box recommendations. You'll be rewarded with the joy of seeing and hearing one of our most beautiful songbirds. I'll leave you with something Mr. Jack told me once on one of my visits. Quote, "What really makes my day is to get up early in the morning. Just as the sun comes up and hear bluebirds." This article was edited for Time. From the music department, Mr. North Carolina, longtime performer Jim Lauderdale is a de facto ambassador for his home state's music by David Menconi. Several months in advance of Merlefest, Jim Lauderdale's dance card was already packed with scheduled performance slots on 3 out of the festival's 4 days. And yet, that will probably represent just a fraction of the time he'll spend on stage in Wilkesboro the last weekend of April. If this year goes the way the past quarter century has, he'll most likely be called on to sit in with numerous other artists. And those cameo appearances just about always lead to other things. After playing with Ralph Stanley in the late 1990s, Lauderdale teamed up with the Bluegrass Patriarch to record 1999's I Feel Like Singing Today. Backing up Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Elvis Costello a few years later landed Lauderdale on Costello's 2009 album, Secret, Profane, and Sugarcane. And Lauderdale's own 2020 LP, When Carolina Comes Home Again, featured an all North Carolina cast of pickers and singers he's connected with at different Merlefests over the years. Merlefest has been really important to me as far as good fortune and life-changing situations, says Lauderdale. There's this level of excitement as soon as you come in. You really have to bring your A game. There are all these world-class players, and you want to keep up. Lauderdale is a prose pro, a multiple Grammy winner who's written songs for George Strait, The Chicks, George Jones, and many others. Country, folk, rock, bluegrass, and other flavors of Americana run through his own 37-album discography, and he sings in a personable drawl that makes you feel like you know him, even if you've never met. In person, Lauderdale's graying mane and immaculately turned-out wardrobe of Western pearl-snap shirts make him hard to miss. He's a perennial favorite at festivals beyond Merlefest, and his frequent awards show host, Star Turns, have turned Lauderdale into a mascot for Americana. During the 15 years he spent as recurrent Americana Music Association Awards show host in Nashville, Lauderdale used to deadpan after every act's performance, "Now that's Americana!" No wonder Steve Eisenstadt, bassist in the local Johnny Cash tribute act, Johnny Folsom IV, says of Lauderdale, "He's the most interesting man at Merlefest." While he's lived in Nashville for more than 3 decades, Lauderdale's native state of North Carolina remains the place he thinks of as home. Born in the small Iredell County town of Troutman, he grew up in different towns across both Carolinas before going off to University of North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem and his Nashville career. I still can't quite put my finger on what it is about the atmosphere there, But North Carolina is just home, Lauderdale says. When I'm here, I feel like this is my place. Not to make it into any sort of unreal fantasy thing, but there's a vibe of ingrained sweetness about the people I know from North Carolina. A goodness and decency I really appreciate as I travel the world. Lauderdale is enough of an ambassador for the Old North State's music for the North Carolina Museum of History to tap him in recent years as its musical host. He served as master of ceremonies for several of their live music series, including Southern Songbirds, Moonshine and Motorsports, and Tar Heel Troubadours. Lauderdale will turn 68 2 weeks before Merlefest 2025, and he shows no sign of slowing down. But if he were to ever retire, it would be to North Carolina. Years ago, he bought a place in Flat Rock near Asheville as a family estate. Flat Rock was where we were going every summer since I was a baby, to a church assembly place, says Lauderdale. I plan to keep the place forever, even though it was, unfortunately, damaged in the flood. But I'm getting it fixed. This article was edited for Time. From our calendar, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., Ralston Blooms returns to North Carolina State's J.C. Ralston Arboretum, a celebration of all things nature. This family-friendly event is set on the beautiful grounds of the public garden. Enjoy the impressive birdhouse competition, hands-on crafts, gardening talks, and plenty of scrumptious food truck options. You can also take advantage of the Arboretum's plant sale, which offers a rare opportunity to score unique native and exotic saplings. Tickets start at $5. The Arboretum is at 4415 Barrel Road. Visit jcra.ncsu.edu for more information. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.